Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Long before he became paramount leader of China, Deng Xiaoping famously quoted an old proverb from his native Sichuan. It doesn't matter whether the cat is black or white as long as it catches mice. That got him in trouble in Mao Zedong's 1960s communist China. In the 1970s, Deng became boss, and that pragmatic attitude drove China's spectacular economic rebirth. A new biography tells the story of the man and his country's explosive rise. This hour on Point, eminent East Asia scholar Ezra Vogel on Deng Xiaoping and the rise of China. You can join the conversation. Do you remember the little man in the 10-gallon cowboy hat in Texas, smiling at the USA, the reformer remaking China, the tough party boss ordering guns into Tiananmen Square? What's the lesson from Deng Xiaoping? You can comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Joining me now in the studio is the celebrated Asia scholar Ezra Vogel, professor emeritus at Harvard University, one of the world's top interpreters of East Asia, author in 1979 of Japan as Number One, Lessons for America. It was the all-time bestseller in Japan of nonfiction by a Western author, author of Living with China. His new 700-page biography is Deng Xiaoping and the Transformation of China. Ezra Vogel, welcome to On Point.
Thanks a lot, Tom. I'm glad to do this, not only because I know you have a distinguished program, because I remember you in the 1970s as a Yale and China person, and I know you know a great deal about China and Asia.
Well, it's been a long time, and a long time since we first started talking about what was going on in Asia and China. You helped mentor me out that way a little bit, and I'm grateful for that. And here's kind of a terrific, enormous history, the labor of years on Deng Xiaoping, the man who, you've got it right in your title, you say, transformed China. What's the transformation that we've seen?
From a poor country that had about $40 per capita income, where 30, 40 people had just died of famine a few years ago.
30, 40 million
mm-hmm. People had died a few years mm-hmm. before he came to power. It was a very disorganized, chaotic country from the Cultural Revolution. And step by step, he led it across the river by grabbing stones across the river and transformed China into a country. I did this because I felt that American people ought to understand China and understand this transformation. And he's the man that led it.
And the transformation into a country that is now just an absolute, explosive, towering economic power.
It has plenty of problems. There is corruption. There is inequality. The leaders are very worried about various kinds of problems. It's still got 100 million people under the poverty line. But it's, as you say, it's going to be the power in the next decades that rivals the United States, and we need to know a great deal about it.
The United States is thinking right now about its own present and its future, whether it's, you know, peeking out or just wandering a little bit on its own, looking for its new way forward. Vice President Biden just recently in China saying, you know, China's rise is not our demise, lots of American strengths, and we will act on those. But you've got the perspective on China to talk to us for just a second about it. Here was an enormous great power for millennia, not just centuries,
right,
but millennia,
right,
that lost its way for 200 years.
Right.
How does that happen? How did that happen with China? Very broad stroke. How did such a great power come to lose its way before it came back?
The way the leaders ruled the country was a very minimalist organization. They didn't have transport, communication. And then there was new technology and new commerce that grew up around the edges
of the empire,
and the leaders could no longer control it. And to transform a society that big, maybe 300 or 400 million at the time,
mm-hmm. we're talking stretched here 18th, 19th, 20th, early 20th century.
Exactly, it was stretched out over such a huge area
mm-hmm.
That it took a great deal. It's not just like having an election or saying we're going to vote for somebody. It required whole new institutions, whole ways of doing these things. And it took a long time to get to where they were in 1978 when Deng took over and began to transform the country.
Mao Zedong set the stage. It ultimately appears, though who knew it at the time, but set the stage for Deng Xiaoping. What was Mao's role in this kind of gathering of China back together? He had famine and a lot more problems, kind of tyranny in his time. But yet there was something going on there important.
Mao, in his own way, was a brilliant leader who pulled the country together, who focused the country to unify against the Japanese and mm-hmm. then against the Kuomintang. Mm-hmm. And then he came to power and unified the country. But then he began to make errors. He had never been abroad. He had no perspective on what to do about the country. He tried to go too fast. He pushed the people too hard. He tried to continue the revolution, and it devastated the country. So from mid-1950s until he passed away in 1976, they made terrible decisions, and the country was in a huge mess. And it was 2 years later when Deng came to power and began to pull things together.
Now, Deng didn't come out of nowhere. He was a long-time kind of right-hand man, occasionally banished, but you say Mao Zedong always had in his back pocket this little 4'11", diminutive, but very determined guy, Deng Xiaoping. What was his role during the Mao years before Mao passed and he took the country's leadership himself?
Way back in the 1920s, Deng had the responsibility for trying to create revolution in Guangxi and set up a rural base.
Southern China.
He failed miserably. Mao Zedong at that time had confronted the same circumstances and had succeeded and set up a base in Jiangxi for the communists to begin to grow their power so they could take over the country. And Deng was enormously impressed. He felt that any organization had to have leadership and discipline. And Mao was the leader, and he was going to follow and support him. He was a brilliant person, effective organizer, and Mao used him. And in the 1930s, Deng got in trouble in the party for being a leader of the Mao faction. So Mao liked Deng way back from the early 1930s and supported him, always considered him one of his most promising successors. And even when he batted him down, he always thought the guy might come back, and of course he did.
When he was a Maoist, he was fully a Maoist. I mean, he helped Mao implement exactly some of those economic policies that were so disastrous in the 50s and 60s. He was sometimes his henchman. I mean, they jailed, purged half a million Chinese intellectuals and scholars in the 1950s, the anti-rightist campaign. Deng led that.
He was a disciplined supporter of Mao. He even began to help support the Great Leap Forward until about 1959.
Which turned out to be a great leap into famine.
Exactly. And Deng realized that. Deng was always, he was never up there with Mao in philosophy and writing books. He was always given practical assignments to deal with real problems. And when he could see the Great Leap Forward was such a disaster, what he tried to do was get along with Mao quietly, mm-hmm. at the same time stay a little distance so that he could begin in his own sphere to carry out what he thought was more pragmatic policies. And he began to do that, and Mao felt that he wasn't listening closely enough, and so they split again. And at Mao's death, he and Deng were no longer close together. But he didn't punish Deng the way he punished other people. He always felt that this is a guy who had been very loyal, had done a lot, and had leadership potential.
Deng first talked about that doesn't matter if it's a black cat or a white cat as long as it catches mice way back in the early 1960s.
Yes.
He didn't get to implement that kind of pragmatism until Mao Zedong was gone.
After the Great Leap Forward in the early 1960s, he was allowed to lead some retrenchment. Mao realized things were so bad that he had to make some adjustments. And so Deng was able to do a little bit in the early 60s. He was able to do it in 1975 when Mao said we got to bring some more order to the country. But as you say, he couldn't really implement it until after 1978.
Was there a question after Mao's death about which way China would go? How did Deng emerge from that as the power who would allow pragmatism with full Communist Party control? And he never, never let up on that, as you fully point out. But how did he get the reins?
When Mao died in the last year before he died, he appointed Hua Guofeng, who depended on his power for carrying out Mao's wishes. And so he felt confident that this person would thoroughly carry out his wishes. He purged Deng. But then the followers felt that Deng was needed because of his leadership experience. And so he was brought back by other high-level leaders in the party. And at first, he and Hua began to work together in 1977. And then gradually, the party leaders felt Hua didn't quite have what it took to really lead the country. And they turned to Deng. And in December 1978, he became the preeminent leader.
Did he ever find a contradiction between being such a Communist Party disciplinarian and the essentially market-driven, essentially capitalist dynamic that he put into such big effect?
No. And way back when he went to the Soviet Union for a year, in 1926-27, Soviet Union had the national economic new economic policy at that time, which was party-led, but it was free market capitalism. Also, in 1949-52, when Deng first took over the Southwest and was responsible for that, it was before they built socialism. So the party led it, but it was free market capitalism. So Deng had lots of experience, and he was confident that the Communist Party had the ability to provide overall leadership and still have market economy. It took a lot of adjustment, but he was confident he could do it.
Asia scholar Ezra Vogel is with us. He's got a big new biography out, Deng Xiaoping and the Transformation of China. Behind us right here, music from Deng's visit to the United States in the 1970s. We'll talk about that. You can join us. Do you remember when Deng Xiaoping put on the big cowboy hat in Houston, the tiny leader with the 10-gallon Stetson? I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. Tom Ashbrook, this is On Point. We're talking this hour with eminent East Asia scholar Ezra Vogel about the man behind China's astounding rise, the paramount leader Deng Xiaoping. On January 28th, 1979, then Vice Premier Deng Xiaoping made his visit to President Jimmy Carter in the White House. Deng spoke here of cooperation between the U.S. and China and normalization of diplomatic relations.
We will be exploring with your government leaders and with friends in all walks of life, ways to develop our contacts and cooperation in the political, economic, scientific, technological, and cultural fields. Normalization opens up broad vistas for developing these contacts and cooperation to our mutual benefit. We have every reason to expect fruitful results.
Deng Xiaoping there behind the interpreter at the White House in 1979. And here was the American president, Jimmy Carter, at that same meeting.
The United States of America has major interest in the Asian and in the Pacific regions. We expect that normalization of relations between our two countries will help to produce an atmosphere in the Asia and Pacific area in which the right of all peoples to live in peace will be enhanced.
Ezra Vogel is with us. His huge new biography is Deng Xiaoping and the Transformation of China. He's been deep in this relationship and this nation's work, China's work, for many, many years. How have you come to understand what was on Deng Xiaoping's mind back in those days? You know, I mean, you sort of sum up his thing as don't argue, try it. If it works, let it spread. But what? They'd been Maoist. Now, what was China going to be? What was his – did he have a vision?
Well, one way was to read all of his speeches, to go through the record of all the things he said, and then look at what he did. The Chinese sometimes say, we listen to the words, but we look at the actions.
Mm-hmm.
I had a good chance to see a lot of people who met Deng, all the way from lowly people. By the way, that interpreter who was speaking there is Ji Chao Ju, who was a Harvard student in the late 40s, having grown up in the United States, went back to China to be the interpreter in 1950.
One of the rare people who spanned those worlds in those years.
Who spanned those worlds. Mm-hmm. And Deng, therefore, learned observed. He was a very pragmatic person from the beginning. He had enormous range of experiences, and he could see what worked, and he could see, he remembered China and remembered Russia before collectivism, and he realized that the best way was to reduce the control of the state, and he carried it out systematically, step by step, and didn't move so quickly that the conservatives could cause him trouble. They slowed him down, but they didn't stop him.
When did it begin to come clear that this was going to work? I mean, there were I was there a lot in the 80s. It was still a country with unbelievable poverty, by no means the powerhouse it is today, but clearly changing.
I think 1984 was the big time when it was clear that it was working, because agricultural production had gone way up. In 1978, there were people starving and they were short of grain. But when they liberalized agriculture and allowed families to do their own farming, they began to increase the grain. Markets began to come on. People could buy groceries on the street in the little markets. They could see the country was going in a good direction. It was orderly. And so the people greeted him at that National Day that year. Deng Xiaoping, ni hao. How are you? How are you, Xiaoping?
Mm-hmm.
Called
him by his first name, unlike Chairman
exactly.
Mao.
Exactly. It was Chairman Mao was too distant and reverential, too much mm-hmm. awe. Mm-hmm. Deng they could greet as a friendly leader who's put him on the right path.
How did he know, though? You say he saw in the Soviet Union earlier examples of market forces working alongside the Communist Party. But obviously that didn't have a great outcome ultimately in the Soviet Union. How did he know that in China's case, at least so far, he could have explosive market-driven, largely market-driven growth and Communist Party control? There were big challenges to that. We saw Tiananmen. But how did he know those would live together?
There was no way he could be sure. But he had seen it work, and he had confidence in the senior leaders that he brought back. They had a lot of administrative experience, and though they were criticized in the Cultural Revolution and pushed down, they too realized there was something wrong with the system and needed to be changed, and they were ready to follow him. And so step by step, he could see that it was working, and he had a broad historical perspective. He had thought about history, and he lived for 60 years under very different kind of circumstances in France, in mm-hmm. Russia, in various parts of China. And he could see pragmatically, step by step, that things were working.
But he never wanted to have the kind of democratic liberalizing reform. His son, I believe it was his son, said to you that his dad thought Gorbachev was an idiot.
That's right.
Why?
He thought that Gorbachev was an idiot because he got rid of the party before they had solved the economic problems. Deng felt that to rule a country that big, you had to have a tightly organized country. You had to have order. They had so much disorder where millions of people had died in internal warfare and famine, that it required in that huge country a discipline and organization in order to make it work.
Did he think that one day democracy might be appropriate, or was China perpetually the enormous country where the iron fist would ultimately be required?
When he was in the Soviet Union, he wrote a paper that's now been made available by a Russian scholar, in which he said, how much democracy you have depends on the political situation in the country. In 1978, when he came to power, you remember he started Democracy Wall and allowed people to write up all kinds of things on the wall. We called it at that time, and they called it Democracy Wall. But when they began to criticize the party and began to criticize too many things, he felt the mood was changing and needed tighter discipline, pulled back. He, again, 1980, 1986, he began to move towards more democracy. But when he felt the conditions were too loose and things were getting out of control, then he cracked down. The big crackdown, as you said, is 1989 at Tiananmen.
And as you write, that was not loosely tied to Deng Xiaoping. The crackdown was, as you describe it, directly orchestrated by Deng Xiaoping. He was watching. He was assembling the troops, 100,000-plus troops. around the square where we all saw the young people with the Goddess of Democracy and the rest. He had them in tunnels and the Great Hall of the People and military museums nearby. I mean, he was directly involved in the violent suppression of that movement.
That movement, in a way, was the perfect storm. There was no leader at that time who was good at working with students. Zhao Ziyang, who at that time was general secretary, was a somewhat aloof, brilliant at economic strategy, but not good at working students. If Zhou Enlai were alive and worked with students, that could have worked. The students were a new left, so you couldn't really deal with them as an organized way. You couldn't make a deal with some and then carry it out. So, and they had to be quiet and pull punches until Gorbachev left Beijing, so that things really got out of control. The students, in some of the early days when of the student movement, when they tried to handle things peacefully, the students broke through the police lines and gave them confidence that they could do all kinds of things. Deng felt when things got out of control, he had to send in the troops. When he first sent in the troops on May 20th, 1989, mm-hmm. they were unarmed. And there were so many citizens, so many students blocking the troops that he was then confronted with the dilemma, what do you do then? And he regrouped, sent in the troops, and ordered them to do whatever they needed to do to reestablish order. And they did reestablish order by shooting a lot of people on the way to Tiananmen Square.
Americans have seen enormous gatherings of people on the National Mall in Washington, D.C. We've never assembled 100,000 troops and sent them in with rifles. You know, in the suppression of Tiananmen, as you write, no one knows exactly how many, 300, 2,000, some large number killed and many wounded as well. You remind us, Deng told his colleagues who had concerns about how this would be seen globally, he said that the West will forget. The rest of the world will forget. What about Deng Xiaoping himself? Did he ever feel guilt or remorse about those deaths on Tiananmen?
I wasn't able to talk to him and find out, but all
the
signs. You talked
to his family. You came as close as anybody will.
Mm-hmm. I talked to his family, and as nearly as I can tell, he didn't. He was a soldier. And when, as a soldier, he was a soldier for 12 years in wartime soldier. He had seen a lot of deaths and a lot of fighting, and he felt he did what he needed to do. In 1989, he felt that he had to do that in order to reestablish order, and he felt that he did the right thing, and I personally think he had no qualms. He was sad about it. He knew it was costly to him, to the nation, to the reputation around the world, but he was confident it was the right thing to do when the country was in danger of falling into the same chaos that it had been in the 200 years.
You don't condone it in the book exactly, but you do point out immediately that Chinese economic stature has grown enormously since that time, since 1989. The implication is that maybe it wouldn't have if there hadn't been a crackdown there. But why not? Why not a little more liberal democratic freedom and economic growth?
I share all the horrors that Americans, other Americans feel about that crackdown. But if you look at it historically, it is true that after that crackdown, China has enjoyed 20 years of peace and growth that's far different from the chaos before 1949. So from Deng's point of view and from the point of view of those leaders, that it was necessary in such a chaotic country to have that crackdown in order to ensure that stability. It's not easy, as in the United States, where we have a fairly high standard of living. We have now a lot of, 10% unemployed. They had hundreds of millions who really had no work and not enough to eat. And it's not easy to rule a country that size.
Ezra Vogel is with us. His big new book is Deng Xiaoping and the Transformation of China, and it has certainly been that. Let's go to our listeners. Mike is calling from Lanesboro, Massachusetts. Hi, Mike. You're on the air with Ezra Vogel.
Hi, Tom, and Ezra. My question would be, was there a certain point in time that is sort of on the record that Deng decided, we're going to change our ways, we are going to buy technology from the United States and the rest of the world, and then we're going to turn that on the world, and we're going to start manufacturing their products?
I think there was a point in 1977 when he came back where he decided that the way to modernize, the most important thing in modernization was to get technology. And he sent people all around the world to study. He wasn't concerned about how well China is doing compared to the other countries. He wanted China to do better. And there was never anything in his relations with the foreign countries that suggested that he wanted to have bad relations. All the things that he said was that he wanted to continue, and he wanted to live harmoniously. He felt that to continue to progress, they couldn't spend too much on the military. The Soviet Union made an error by putting so much on the military that they couldn't concentrate on developing the country. He wanted good relations with other countries because he felt that was good for China and good for domestic development.
And so he got that domestic development, but he was very focused on the United States. Part of the reason for the normalization was, you say, he looked out, he saw if they were going to have the technology and industry they needed, there were American patents behind so much of what was going on in the world.
Exactly.
I mean, this was very pragmatic. Even that big smile in Texas with what the girl rode by at the rodeo with the cowboy hat on his head.
But he believed in science. You know, some of the people he saw most in 1977 were Chinese-American Nobel Prize winners, scientists, and he kept going back to them. And he had five kids. One was too sick to be a scientist. One studied medicine, and three studied physics. I think that gives some idea. His wife had studied physics in college. I think it gives some idea of how important he considered science as the basis for technological development.
Mm. Easley, calling from Cambridge, Massachusetts. Easley, you're on the air. Thanks for calling.
Hi, Tom, and congratulations, Ezra. You were kind enough to share a draft of your Chapter 7 of the book with me when I was interested in that policy of openness and the role of Singapore and that 13th Party Congress. I'd like for you to talk a little bit more about that.
13th Party Congress, what year, Singapore, what was going on, Ezra Vogel?
Well, Singapore was opened in 1978 to Deng Xiaoping when he visited there. He had visited there in 1920 on the way to France, and he could see the huge growth that Singapore had made, admired what they had done, how neatly they had developed. There were some people who said Chinese civilization was not able to modernize. 75% of the people in Singapore were ethnic Chinese. He could see they were making it. It was enormous encouragement to see that they had figured out how to progress orderly. The 13th Party Congress was 1987. That was Zhao Ziyang's conference. Deng at that time had thought that Zhao would be the successor and was ready to allow more freedoms, more openness, more democracy, even more markets. And that was the spirit of that Congress in 1987.
More openness, and that's 87. And then 2 years later, you've got 89, so not that much more openness.
Deng said you have to look at the conditions. And in 1989, when there were a lot of students on the street, he felt that you had to clamp down more. And But 3 years later, he came back and pushed more market opening again. And he was willing to move more towards freedom if the political situation was stable enough to permit it. And when it wasn't, he would crack down.
Meanwhile, the Chinese economy has grown and grown and grown. Ezra Vogel is with us. His book is Deng Xiaoping and the Transformation of China. We've got more music here. This is the anthem of the People's Republic of China. Chinese military band played at the memorial service for Deng Xiaoping, February 1997. Over 10,000 Chinese political leaders, officials, relatives, friends attending. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour with East Asia scholar Ezra Vogel about the man behind China's astounding rise, the paramount leader, Deng Xiaoping. Big new biography by Ezra Vogel is Deng Xiaoping and the Transformation of China. You can read an excerpt at our website at onpointradio.org. Let Let me get a call from Betsy in Exeter, New Hampshire. Hi, Betsy. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
A number of years ago, I'm a teacher, and a number of years ago I had an advisee who was from China. At the beginning of the year, when he first came, his father talked to me to tell me about his son and told me a little bit about his family. His parents were illiterate and lived in the country, and he himself had gotten a good education, and he said, think what you will about Deng Xiaoping, he gave me an education. The man has gone on to be a very successful member of an international, large international firm, and has used some of the money he's earned to rehabilitate, in some ways, the village that his parents live in, to bring it good water and kind of spruce up the village. I thought it was a very interesting way of understanding what Deng Xiaoping had brought to China.
Betsy, I appreciate your call. Ezra Vogel, that is the, kind of the tone of your book. Think what you will, but look what he's done for the country. Is that your perception of how the Chinese see the transformation that Deng wrought?
There are a lot of different views in China. Some intellectuals feel he quashed freedom and didn't do enough to push it, and that he could have succeeded and avoided the horrors of Tiananmen if he had just opened up a little more. Some of them think that Mao's revolutionary ideas were better, and that in the old days, when there was no nouveau riche and no open markets, that things were more orderly. But
inequality certainly, but then there wasn't, everybody was,
it was equality
poor.
in poverty.
Mm-hmm.
But I think most Chinese feel enormously grateful to Deng Xiaoping, whatever they say. He was the man who turned China around and put it on a steady course of improvement and growth and made it a strong country that people in China can now be proud of. And in terms of education, in 1977, when he came back, the schools have been closed for 10 years. Universities have been shut down. He not
cultural,
only
cultural revolution and all the rest.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. And he decided that they needed to be open. You needed entrance examinations. You needed quality. You needed standards. Before that, they had been recommended to go to college, and the party leaders who were strong were able to get their own favorite people into the mm-hmm. college, no matter how dumb they were.
Mm-hmm.
And he wanted standards in the schools, and so in 1977, he reopened with the unified national exams, pushed it ahead, and all the students who passed those exams and went to the universities have been enormously grateful ever since.
David in Oak Grove, Kentucky. David, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
When I think about capitalism, I think about basic freedoms that we have, freedom of religion, freedom of choice of vocation. In China, as I understand it, they don't have those kinds of freedom, and we're forced in this country to buy in our big box stores products that are made in China instead of the United States because there's unfair labor practices going on there. They don't have collective bargaining or the basic rights that we have here. So I don't think that it's correct to call China a capitalistic country. I think it's a communist country, and I think it's unfair that we have giant corporations here that go to China and open up factories instead of coming to the United States where we fight for freedom and where we're supposed to stand for freedom and economic freedom and things of this nature. And China is just not that way. So I'm confused whenever people refer to China as a capitalistic country. I think it's a communist country where they do not have the rights that we have as workers, and they can't even have basic freedoms. So I think it's unfair. And
David, we got it. And you're saying that bleeds right over in influence into the American situation. I'm very glad you raised that because it is hard to pin down what exactly it is that we're working with here. We've got others online, Ezra. Let me put this one to you. Jack says, please ask Professor Vogel, what makes China a communist state? It sounds more like a fascist state, capitalist economy, authoritarian government. What is this amalgam? And what about our caller, David, is concerned that the lack of freedoms in China end up affecting American workers here?
That's a great question, and I think there are many ways I agree with those comments. I believe it is true that China does not exactly have capitalism like we do. They have open
certainly
markets,
mm-hmm.
and I think we have to distinguish capitalism as it's practiced here And in China, the government still owns the land. It parcels out the land to the local people. It still has a higher group of state enterprises than we do. It has economic planning. So it's not exactly capitalism. It's markets without capitalism. But there is a great deal more freedom under Deng than there had been before. Religion is somewhat controlled, but there is a great deal more religion. I first went to China in 1973, and when I went walked on the streets, people were afraid to talk to me. I can remember in 1980 when I spent 2 months there of people still being terrified. And now, with my Chinese intellectual friends, I can discuss everything, including their views of the leaders in the party that are critical, as long as they don't publish it. There is enormous open discussion.
And yet, you know that there's also a lot of concern about speaking too openly about things. We've been reading about how people just disappear for a long time. People get beat up by gangs of toughs who are clearly associated with the government. I mean,
there are those things, and I agree with them, and I agree those are problematic. I think we hear about them more than the average Chinese person does. And I think if you were on the ordinary in the street living as a Chinese, most of those dissidents would not come into your scope. You wouldn't think about them because within your life, ordinary people have quite a bit of freedom as long as they don't publicly carry on demonstrations and criticize the government.
Or organize labor.
Or carry out organizations that the government feels are threatening. But in terms of labor, I don't think that Americans are forced to buy Chinese products. I think we buy them because they're cheaper. And I think Chinese workers work in those factories because they get a hell of a lot better situation than they had in the countryside when they were very poor. The Chinese who have gone to work in those factories develop a higher standard of living. They develop a better understanding of the outside world. They improve their lives. And they choose to go and work in those factories.
Well, they choose up against poverty in the countryside. Americans choose to buy the cheaper products. But then you can hear what David's saying. We're kind of funneled into these big box stores where the Walmart spigot starts in China and ends up right there. And with the unemployment and wages what they are, you don't have a lot of choice for most Americans. That's where you're going to shop.
The world we're now in a world market, and those who work for less will produce products that will sell in countries where we have higher wages. I think the future is that the gap between the wages of the Chinese and Americans will narrow, and exactly how that takes place will not be fun for all the Americans, but it'll improve the lives of the poorest people in the world.
Joe Biden, our vice president, just came back recently from China. He wrote an essay. Headline was, China's Rise Isn't Our Demise. And he said a number of interesting things in there. But let me go to this one. He said, the nature of 21st century competition favors the United States. He looks at China. He looks at the United States. Of course, he's the vice president. He's pretty much got to say this. But let's take it on its merits. He says, the United States, because of its political system, its economic system, the way we educate our children, our tolerance for free expression, rule of law, all these things mean that the 21st century competition favors the United States. Do you agree, Ezra Vogel?
I think there are a lot of ways in which I agree. In terms of American universities, the openness, freedom of speech, higher education, technological innovation, flexibility, I think that we are way ahead. On the other hand, you have to admit that with tighter organization, China can make more rapid, take the transport system. We've had trouble getting really fast trains from New York to Boston. China has put in hundreds of miles of fast train in a very short time.
But, of course, they can just roll right over every homeowner and farm owner between Beijing and Shanghai, the eminent domain. I mean, they just move people out.
The calculus there is what's good for the greatest number, and that's what's good for the smaller number.
Mm-hmm.
And so they don't protect rights, and they don't protect people.
But how does that ultimately work competitively? Joe Biden, again, says open and free societies are best at promoting long-term growth, stability, prosperity, and innovation. Do you agree?
There are some ways.
Because I'm not sure reading your book. I honestly don't know if you agree or not.
Like all good professors, I think it's complicated, and you got to see different sides. Mm-hmm. I think on the side of creating new technology, new ideas, exchange of ideas, we're ahead. On the other hand, in terms of rapidly, for example, urban renewal, mm-hmm. they can tear down old buildings and put up new ones much faster than we can. We will say that doesn't protect freedoms. So I think it's a complicated issue where there are some things that favor their side and some things that favor our side.
Do you think it's as clear as the vice president? He says the nature of 21st century competition favors the United States.
I think that puts the good side on. But I think in terms of producing inexpensive products and producing, for example, solar panels on a very large scale at low price, in terms of improving transport infrastructure, the Chinese can do it faster in their system. And I think we would be blind not to recognize that.
They've got a lot more progress to make. Do you think that it works to a mutual benefit that they make that progress? I mean, solar panels. We've just had a big solar company shut down in our backyard right here because competition from China.
That's what world markets do. And I think they're going to be pains. You know, when capitalism started coming into China in the 20s and 30s mm-hmm. of the last century, mm-hmm. There were a lot of people who were very upset that it was interfering with their old ways.
In China, you mean?
In China. Mm-hmm. And yet it brought in a lot of new products, a lot of new ideas, a lot of innovation. Deng embraced those changes and says, we got to keep up the world. We're part of the world. We can't separate off. We got to adjust and make ourselves competitive in those international markets. I think the United States now faces a global competition in producing goods and in producing services, and we have to compete in that system.
Deng embraced those ideas with a little revolution, communist revolution
in between. Absolutely.
Let's go to Spokane, Washington, and Neil. Hi, Neil. You're on the air with Ezra Vogel.
Hi, Tom. Neil Seelock in Spokane. Dr. Vogel, pleasure to talk to you again, sir, as one of your previous students as a National Security Fellow in the 90s.
Nice to be in touch.
The Deng's dichotomy of having to deal with double-digit growth and his concerns, as you taught us, of a runaway locomotive that he was concerned about way back in the early 90s.
Runaway locomotive of inflation? Neil?
Negative, of the double-digit growth in the country itself. And he was afraid, as Dr. Vogel taught us, that that the economy just couldn't take that kind of growth year after year.
Oh, just simply the speed of the growth. What a problem to have, right. But what about it? Ezra Vogel?
I think that Deng's view was that overwhelmingly the good points are much better than the bad points. He did understand that too high inflation is very upsetting to the people, and it could cause a lot of problems and through a lot of adjustments, and that in 1978-79, when he first came to power, he decided that China had to cut back on some of its investments because they couldn't pay for them. So you had to run an organized economy, and there had to be balance. His instincts were toward going faster, but he realized that there had to be some constraints.
You pointed out that Deng was very into harmony with other nations to leave the way open for development.
Right.
Now China's had a lot of development, gigantic development, and you can't go to China without feeling the nationalism there. Even on Vice President's visit, we saw the Georgetown team and that Chinese professional basketball team with a lot of former Army guys, you know, going at it on the court. It's tough. What about the new leadership? Are they as committed to that harmony for development for everybody, or has nationalism got its nose under the tent?
It's a great question. I think that's the way people are now debating. Is the Deng message that we need to cooperate with other countries and have good relations and learn from them, is that the dominant new trend? Or now that China is stronger, can't we stand up for our interests a little better? And can't we push the United States on Taiwan? Can't we declare that the South China Seas really belongs to China? Can't we push things farther? The leaders in the crunch when Hu Jintao visited the United States this year, he was able to get things under control and push for more harmony with other countries. But I think that's going to be the issue of the next generation of Deng's leaders. Can they continue Deng's view that they should cooperate with other countries for internal development? That's in China's interests. I think the dominant answer is yes, Deng is right, and it's still appropriate for us to continue that, but it's an open issue.
We've just got half a minute. Where do you think this progress train that Deng Xiaoping set off ultimately arrives? China's a billion-plus people. Could we see it with a level of affluence on a par with the United States and Europe? Is that where it goes? What's the end point?
It's difficult for me to see much beyond 50 years. And since I'm 80 years old, these will be problems that my grandchildren may think about. But I think it's unlikely within 50 years that the Chinese average person will be as well as off as those in the United States and Europe. There will be pockets of affluence, or already are.
Certainly.
The country as a whole will continue to grow economically. I'm afraid China is going to have a lot of problems in the next few years as growth slows down. It's a tough thing for them to face, as it was for Japan and for the United States, now that our growth is slowing down. And now that we are confronted with a global competition, there will be India that will come up. And so I think it's not going to be an easy road for China either, but I think that they will be a stronger, richer country with more influence around the world in the next half century.
Talk about an epic story. This is it. The big biography is Deng Xiaoping and the Transformation of China. Ezra Vogel, Professor Emeritus at Harvard, it's great to see you. Thank you very much for coming in.
Thank you, Tom.
Listeners, thanks for joining us. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.